Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to interesting and inspiring women about their lives, influences, and their mantras on how they live their lives, which helps us overcome challenges in our own lives. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Jessica Bennett from all the way over in New York. I assume you're in New York. Hi, and welcome, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, fine. Thank you. Thanks for your time. Wow. Jessica Bennett is an award-winning journalist, a best-selling author, and speaker who writes on gender, on politics and culture, and was the first gender editor of the New York Times and is now their editor at large. I mean, wow, what a career, Jessica. That's one mighty career with one fantastic newspaper. How's it going over there in the States then?
You know, it's been pretty sunny and warm here in New York the last few days, which has been really a respite. And so I've been trying to get outside, but otherwise we're all pretty isolated, as I'm sure you are as well.
It's hard, isn't it? It's so hard. Gosh, we'll look back and hopefully laugh on this. And you've got an awful lot going on over there as well. And in fact, you know, we normally avoid politics or religion, but really we can't avoid it at the moment. We were going to chat a month or so ago, so actually the timing is perfect for us. And for the layman and people that don't understand politics out there, dare we mention it, the atmosphere around the election for you. Have you got a result yet? Is it one step and giant leap for womankind, or it's rather sitting on the fence at the moment?
The results are in there, and today's front page of the New York Times, in fact, they called representatives in every single state and found there is no voter fraud, despite what the president may be saying. This is a legal election, and it was really interesting to be in New York City over the weekend because we actually found out about the result by the sound outside of our apartment. We live in Brooklyn. We're on the 7th floor, and suddenly it was like this burst of cheering and horns honking and people banging pots and pans. And so before I even turned back on CNN, I was running to the window to look out. And it was like a city block party in a lot of ways.
I mean, you know, people who aren't even into politics in the UK, we're all avidly watching CNN to see, you know, dare we say it, this pantomime unfolding, really, in terms of what is going on. It's playing with people's lives, isn't it? You know, it's really topical. I enjoyed your November article in the New York Times about the dueling views of masculinity between Trump and Biden. Do you want to tell us about your article?
I mean, this is something that has come up a number of times over the past few months and in the campaign, and with regard to Trump, you know, it's been occurring throughout his time in office. But the way that he conveys this type of macho manhood, you know, he believes and implies that wearing a mask, even in a global pandemic, is weak. And on the debate stage, on the first debate, made fun of his opponent, Joe Biden, for the size of his mask. His mask was apparently too big. He really sort of embodies this type of retrograde, good old boy, crass, macho masculinity that in a lot of ways is really outdated. And then you have Joe Biden, who is in some ways on the other end. He's emotional. You know, he tears up when talking about the death of his son. He's trying to present himself as a leader who is both strong, but also empathetic and compassionate, sort of trying to blend these things to create a more wholesome or fulfilling leader. And yet even he will challenge Donald Trump or a voter to a push-up contest, or like has a campaign ad where he's driving it around in a Corvette, still playing into these symbols of traditional masculinity in some ways. And so the piece was really looking at these two dueling ideas of what it means to be a leader and what it means to be a man, and then looking at some of the history in American history about how white male presidents have conveyed their manhood over time. And it's fascinating to see, like, this is not a new thing, presenting oneself as strong and tough and, you know, down home, and the cowboy boots and the belt buckles has been a part of, you know, every single modicum of leadership that we've seen.
Gosh, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I enjoyed your article and the perspective, as you say. And you referred to the previous election was really all about what a woman should be. And this election is about what a man should be. And that is so insightful. And your views, I really enjoyed. And even you'd mentioned the evocative words of Obama that said kindness, humility, and responsibility are traits of what a man should be. And another feature in your paper was talking about, you know, the differences and the roles and the mastery over the coronavirus. It was just fascinating the way you'd illustrated it. The difference between calm, nurturing, and measured, or the opposite, and really what people are gravitating towards. And as you say, that narrative loss is a very strong one. You know, he's lost his wife, his daughter, and his son, hasn't he? And, you know, that really, really is very shocking and very impactful for people about how caring he now is. So it's fascinating to see how it's unfolded. And I feel sorry for you all over there of how, you know, difficult it must be. You know, it's affecting your lives so deeply and in this environment. We're all there with you and watching it unfold. So you've been editor at large since January 2020. What a year you've had. Congratulations, by the way. But gosh, so much has happened this year on your three genres of gender, politics, and culture. In particular, you couldn't have imagined what the year would entail on all three of those fronts for you, could you?
Well, it's been a weird year in many ways.
That's very humble. It's been a weird year. I mean, everything has happened for women, for politics, for social culture. Everything has changed. I mean, you must have been incredibly busy. So how have you survived lockdown? Have you been working largely from home on your seventh floor?
Yeah, we've been entirely working from home, and people will not return to the New York Times until July of next year, as it
really?
Stands now.
So you'll work from home until then?
Yeah, so it's working from home, which is not bad. I working from home can be nice, but I do live in a New York City apartment that is a loft with no walls, and I have a husband who also works from home, so there's a lot of doing phone calls or conducting my interviews in the bathroom at times.
Oh, no!
In the bathroom, and no green space or roof garden or anywhere. You can go out though, can't you? We're not allowed out.
So we go on walks.
Everyone's taken up walking, haven't they? It's making us all very fit, even though we just otherwise we'll go mad.
But yeah, I mean, I think I've done some reporting on this as well, but like people's relationships are being challenged in this time. Parenting is really difficult. Mothers tend to take on the majority of the burden when it comes to childcare duties. And we did a project a few months back looking at people who live alone, who in many ways are extremely isolated. So there has been so much going on this year, from racial reckoning to politics to health and grief, I think. And I worry to some extent that, you know, we are facing or will be facing a global mental health crisis. Winter is beginning and
affecting the young as well. I was reading something only recently saying how children are, you know, very young children are actually being affected. Their learning is almost going backwards. And I think everyone is impacted, and we're all picking up on each other's energy and stress and strain, aren't we? It's straining everything on every level. It's very sad. Now, you didn't choose to spend it in Joshua Tree in California. Have you got a place over there as well? I think I've read.
So we rent and live primarily in New York. But a couple of years back, we bought a small house in the middle of the desert on like a dirt road in the middle of nowhere in Yucca Valley, California, which is right near Joshua Tree. And the idea was to renovate it to create this kind of peaceful place where I could go and write. And then, of course, like as soon as the renovation was ready, COVID happened. So we haven't been back there.
Oh, bless you. Oh gosh, you'll be desperate. What a place though, a haven of peace and tranquility when you can, when you're allowed.
Well, it's a funny thing is that we liked it because it was so isolated. It was this nice, peaceful place away from the bustle of New York. But now that we're all trapped in our apartments, yeah, I'm like, I don't know if I want to be that isolated.
It's changed people's thinking. And a lot of people that live in London here are now buying so that they can commute into London or work with a view or in the garden or whatever. It's changing people's priorities and needs, isn't it? And how they work and how they live with their living arrangements. Gosh, incredible. So you're an incredible authority as a journalist, both from the role for the New York Times and as a voice representing women. You first shone the light and gender lens on social issues and culture for the New York Times and led an initiative to get more female readers around the globe. How did that go?
Yeah, so When I began my job, let's see, it was in 2017 when I took on this role as gender editor. You know, it was a year after Donald Trump was elected. There had been a longstanding conversation inside the institution that the majority of Times readers were men and the majority of Times subscribers were men. And sort of the more engaged a reader becomes, meaning they're commenting on stories, they're sharing stories on social media, elsewhere, the more likely they are to be men. And so there was this gap in audience. And so there was kind of a business case to be made for why we needed to close that gap. You can't, you know, be a business in the 21st century and not be reaching half of the population. And so the goal was to better engage women readers and to better cover gender issues at large. Now, unbeknownst to me, this was right at the time that the Me Too movement was beginning to erupt. So it was almost as if the culture gave forth this news subject that was galvanizing people all over the globe at the same time that we were trying to better engage women readers and better cover gender issues. And so it worked out well in the sense that this was a subject that I spent the next year or so covering really heavily and was so important that we did. But the idea was really that we needed to better reach women as part of our readership, and how could we do that? And are there different delivery mechanisms you can use to reach women readers, such as newsletters, or, you know, they're more likely to be on social media? And how can we elevate the stories that we were already doing to achieve more visibility, but also better cover issues around the globe? And so that's where we began, and it was part of an initiative that continues.
Amazing. What a journey you've had in those 3 years, you know, and actually, you know, made such steps, giant steps for women. And, you know, you're the author of two best-selling books. Firstly, one with the sensational title Feminist Fight Club, A Survival Manual for a Sexist Workplace. I mean, wow, straight to it. It's been translated into dozens of languages. What brought that about then?
Yeah, so Feminist Fight Club is the book that I wished that I had had when I was beginning my career. It's full of tactics and tools and actionable advice for how to push back against sexism at work. But the title, I mean, obviously it's a play on Fight Club, the movie and book, but I have been in a women's group since I started my career, I don't know, 15 years ago or so now. We're actually getting ready to celebrate our 12th anniversary of the group, but it was a group of women who were all in creative fields and all sort of struggling in different ways and, you know, coming up against things that they weren't quite sure were sexist, but they felt like had something to do with gender. And a lot of the times we were the only women in the room and we were competing for bylines or, you know, jokes getting on air and didn't quite know how to navigate it. So we started meeting in a tiny New York City apartment every month. And we would joke that we were like a feminist fight club because we didn't talk about the group outside of the group. It was like top secret. And that was kind of a wink, wink, funny thing. But at the time there were women in the group who really felt like if word got out that they were in this feminist women's group, they would be penalized at work. And so we didn't talk about the group outside of the group. And so, you know, years passed. We're continuing to support each other. We're helping each other navigate our careers, negotiate salaries, overcome imposter syndrome, all of these things. And we become more open about it. Like the culture changes. It's okay to talk about these things. Like the definition of the word feminist changes in many ways so that people are adopting it. Beyonce is like putting it as a background on her global tours. And it felt like the time had come to talk about the club outside of the club. And so the book uses the group as inspiration, but then really is rooted in data for how to push back against some of the behaviors that many of us still face.
Well, that's brilliant because you had, you know, with your skills and your work, you had the power and the tools to help other people cope with those sort of situations and then to help so many other young people. I mean, it really is a manual meets manifesto, isn't it? A survival guide with your tactical strategies to navigate. But literally everyone I know has had an instance where there has been a sexual reference or something slightly inappropriate you're not sure about in the workplace. And that disrespect, you give them the arsenal of weapons to cope with that now, or to push back, as you say. That attitude and vigour, that youthful, the language even that you've got in some of the cartoons there, smash the patriarchy, and that sort of anger as well is in there, isn't it? Am I allowed to ask, has anything happened to you that has fueled any of that?
I mean, I think throughout the course of my career, I began my career as a writer at Newsweek magazine, where I was coming up with a group of young people who were all reporters, most of them guys, and they were rising up more quickly than I was. And over time, I learned to recognize some of the behaviors, you know, having my ideas repeated in a meeting and attributed to someone else, or stories that I would pitch appearing in the magazine under a man's byline when it was my idea. These types of things, being interrupted in meetings, I started to recognize them as institutional problems, not just like my problem, because it was very easy in some ways, especially when we're dealing with this kind of subtle sexism that's not overt, like they're not saying you can't be a writer or we don't allow women here, but it's these more insidious things that can cause you to wonder, like, is this just me? Are my ideas not good enough? Like, am I not speaking up loud enough? And so it was in part due to my Feminist Fight Club, this group of other women who are experiencing the same things, that I was able to recognize this as institutional problems and patterns, not just my own inadequacies. And so that was a big part of my, I think coming into my own and my career, and ultimately what led me to writing about women's issues as well. So it's very personal, but also rooted in research, because I felt like, you know, you can talk about what's happened to you and it might make for a compelling narrative, but there are still people who won't believe it. Whereas if you're citing studies that prove that the behavior is real in a large scale, I sometimes find it can be much more effective. And so I was really careful about making sure that everything in that book, even when I had a sense of humor about it and could put it into funny language or pop culture references, was really rooted in hardcore data.
Gosh, yes. And that hard-hitting topic, you know, is going to help so many other people who have faced things and give them the confidence, because women have that imposter syndrome and lack that confidence and automatically blame themselves. And in fact, you know, we're not man bashing at all, because we love men, and on this show a quarter of our audience are men, and it's just recognizing the subtleties, isn't it, and knowing when we feel uncomfortable. And that's great that you have illustrated that. So literally, we'd give a shout out to Sheryl Sandberg, who I believe you know and worked with, and we'll come on to that. Describe your book as engaging, hilarious, and practical. So there you go. Now, you've got another book. This is 18, Girls' Lives Through Girls' Eyes, which even rhymes, and I like that. It's a photography book showcasing the lives of teen girls around the world. What made you think of that? Then you wanted to, again, help the young. Was that helping your younger self, or just actually knowing that there is a problem there?
Well, it grew out of a New York Times project. We wanted to do a photography project documenting the lives of 18-year-old girls around the world. We knew that, you know, 18 is this pivotal age in so many countries. You're, to quote Britney Spears, you're not a girl, but not yet a woman. Like, you can vote in some places, but not in others. In some places, you can get a credit card. In some places, you can enlist in the army, but then, like, you're still living with your parents and reliant on them to pay your bills. And so it's this kind of rite of passage. And we thought it would be a really interesting time to document people and what they were going through in that transition. And we wanted to focus on girls because they don't get as much attention, and because girls of that age and more broadly struggle in ways. You know, at that age, they start to lose their self-esteem. They don't believe they can become leaders, all of these things. And normally what we would do in a project like this at an institution like the New York Times is assign a bunch of professional photojournalists to go document these girls. But in this case, we felt like actually members of those girls' own communities could do a better job of getting at the intricacies and the nuances and the very like teenage things of these girls' lives. So that created a very complicated process of needing to find in all of the 21 countries where we photographed and interviewed these young women, another young woman who was a photographer in their community who could document them. And then we paired each of those young women photographers with a mentor so that they would have some professional guidance locally. And they spent months, you know, documenting and following these girls as they went about their daily lives. And so, you know, there was a young woman who was a musician in Iran, and there's a dancer in India, and there are college students in California. And the sheer number of ways that being an 18-year-old girl all had these kind of commonalities. And so we produced this project, and then ultimately it became a book that's a combination of photography by these other young women and interviews with the girls. And it just felt like in a world where women are still underrepresented in creative directors, in photographers, it was really important to almost have that like girl gaze onto the women. Like, we wanted to showcase their lives through other young women's lives. And yeah. And in fact, I think that, you know, having another teenager photograph these girls made them open up a lot more.
And definitely, in someone their age. And I'm the mother of an 18-year-old girl myself, actually. So I'm totally relating to what you're saying, and how they illustrate their lives largely through photos and communications in that way. So that's really interesting. And actually, it's different in America. I don't think you can drink alcohol at 18 until you're 21 either, can you? But you can drive when you're really young, which you can't over here. So there are differences. And obviously, you know, in the Middle East, as you were referring to, you know, there's huge differences all over the world. So our listeners will be interested in that as well, because our listeners range from all sorts of ages. So that's really interesting and a great viewpoint of the world, and very passionate. And a lot of them are young activists at that age. You know, they really know what they feel strongly about with their opinions, and they're not afraid to say them, and they have a voice now much younger, which is brilliant with that immediacy.
One of the most interesting things was that, you know, across continents and time zones and such different experiences, you know, a young woman with a baby at 18, a woman who was married in Bangladesh, like college students, all of them were so informed about what was happening globally in a way that I certainly was not.
They're all young activists. So media representation and empowering a future generation of women, especially teen girls, which we highly commend on the Influential Women podcast. And you've also talked and written about navigating sex and consent on campus, which is a really scary thing, particularly, you know, now I'm experiencing that university trail in terms of the complicated dynamics of sexual consent on campus. And these young adults are all unsupervised and left to their own devices. And you wrote an article about that, Modern Love, didn't you?
Yeah, I've done a number of projects looking at this issue, but a couple of years ago, around as the Me Too movement was exploding, but also as this conversation was erupting around, you know, there is a gray area of consent. It is possible to have two people in a situation who think that different things are going on. And over here, there was a big controversy around Aziz Ansari, the comedian, and this situation that he had been in that a young woman wrote about, and had he done something wrong, and was that also Me Too, and was it sexual assault, or was it sort of a confusion? And so what we wanted to do was get at that gray area, but we wanted to do it through college students' own voices. And so we put out a call asking people to describe these really intimate experiences, and we weren't sure that, you know, people would feel comfortable sharing. In most cases, for the New York Times, we require people to give their full names. We had to fact check everything because it was very sensitive. But in their own words, they described so much of this gray area and how, you know, in some cases, they hadn't really been educated about what it all meant, or like what consent was, or how you get it. And so it was a window into, I think, some of the complexities that have emerged around Me Too, and of course always have existed, but in particular now, when, you know, people are being fired for behavior and there are arguments about whether due process exists, to show that at times there is this murky area.
Very shocking. And, you know, were you giving tips and warnings to how young people should cope with that sort of thing on campus, you know, at university, or not, in other situations as well? Because anything that could be that traumatic, you know, the mental health ramifications and post-traumatic stress are horrendous, you know, of how they could feel after something like that.
Yeah, we always try to provide resources when we do these types of projects. without getting too involved because we're not experts, but providing links and resources to the places who are.
If anyone's troubled by any of these situations in work or, you know, uni or anywhere, then to reach out and to get that support and help. So supporting women and girls is obviously a huge passion to you. Where did that driving force come from? Were you like that as a child?
I don't think so. I have two brothers. So I think I was two younger brothers who are twins. So I was always fighting to get a word in.
Well, that's what it is then.
but I think it's more of like a journalistic passion and mandate. Like I believe in amplifying stories and of creating narratives around people who have been underrepresented. And as a woman, a lot of my focus has ended up there. But I have always thought that the way that I can have the most impact is by telling their stories and allowing people to tell their stories rather than me, you know, advocating for them outright.
Wow. And what a medium to do it on in the New York Times. I mean, amazing. So we both worked at Time Magazine, I see, on your, me probably a long time before. And you worked for Lean In.org. I mean, wow, how was that? Did you know Sheryl Sandberg?
Yeah. So let's see. Long before I was writing for the New York Times, after I worked at Newsweek, I finally left Newsweek, where I had had these sort of, you know, hard experiences around not feeling like my ideas were heard, to go work for Tumblr, the blogging platform, which I feel like these days is known as like basically a platform for porn. But at the time was this new, exciting, interesting thing. And they had hired this team of journalists to do storytelling on the platform. And so I was like, oh, wow, I'm getting out of old media. You know, Newsweek had been put up for sale for $1 and was sold off by the Washington Post and had gone through all of this tumultuous stuff. And I had escaped and gone to new media where they had like free snacks and you could bring dogs to the office and people were like skateboarding around on skateboard. Wow. And then as often happens in tech, they laid us all off like 8 months later. and so we were all out of jobs. And it was right around the time that the book Lean In had come out. And I didn't know Sheryl, but I had interviewed her for a piece about women and negotiation. And so at that time, I reached out to her and said, I think there's a lot of work that you could do around storytelling related to the book. I knew she was launching a foundation and I felt like there was an editorial angle to what she was doing. So I ended up doing some consulting work for them and then ultimately went freelance and started writing for the Times.
Well, how brilliant to interview her though. You know, I'd love to interview her and heard her heart-wrenching story about her own personal life on radio once. And it was so humbling. It really got to me listening to her story on radio and how successful she is in one aspect of her life and how sad it's been in others. So that was really interesting to hear and very sad. So women really do learn from each other and get inspired by each other's energy, even online. I'm enjoying talking, seeing you there. And in fact, we're going to be sharing some of this video for some new interesting clips so people can watch out for that. And I've been at a radio conference this week, actually, online, obviously, and it said it's the chemistry of connection that people are missing. And I think it really is. It's that energy, isn't it? And that connection that people don't get through the screen. They're sort of thinking you can't get those subtle nuances from the body language or when people want to speak or whatever when you're just staring at them. Now, the Influential Women podcast chats about adversity and setbacks and how we can help others get through tough times. And this podcast demonstrates how we can learn from setbacks and thrive and survive. So is there anything that you, adversity wise, or it's mainly through work that you've overcome in terms of thriving and surviving over that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is coming up in a pretty male-dominated field and having to navigate my way through that. You know, I didn't grow up really learning about feminism or considering myself a feminist. I didn't like major in women's studies. Like I studied journalism. And so it was really in my first job out of college where I butted up against this idea that maybe I wasn't getting ahead as quickly as my male colleagues. And like, what was that about? And how come no one had warned me about this? And I was of the girl power generation that was taught we could do anything, anything we put our minds to. And, you know, we graduated from college and higher numbers and we got better grades and blah, 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 blah. And then suddenly I think a lot of us, my peers and I, entered the corporate world or the working world and realized that it was not as progressive or forward-thinking as the universities we had come from. And it took a while to realize, I touched on this before, but to realize that the problem wasn't us. You know, it's so easy to turn inward and say, like, it must just be me. I'm not good enough. My ideas aren't good enough. My writing's not good enough. And especially in a field like writing or journalism, where it's so subjective, there's nothing to compare it to. Someone can just say, like, this isn't good, and you can't really argue with it. So it took a while to figure out that, like, these are institutional problems that have existed forever.
But you're changing so many, and it's so strange, because I look at what you've done and the communities you've set up and the books you've written and the role as editor at large of the New York Times that you've got is so sort of other people would be so in awe of that sort of journey, and yet still so young. It's women still have that imposter syndrome. Is it enough, don't they? And I can hear and feel that from you, that I think you're doing amazingly. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's sick in a way. Like, yeah, I think that this is so common. Like, you know, there's a presentation that you have to the outside world and a way that people perceive you. And then there's, like, the way that you perceive yourself. And I think so many women struggle with that, no matter how many accolades or awards or best-selling books or podcasts they've put out. And so I think it's, you know, a constant battle.
It's that, am I enough, isn't it? And in fact, I've read a book once before where they say you have three columns, and the columns of how others see you and how you see yourself, and some of your friends are reflecting the qualities that you feel as though you lack. And that's how it sort of matches up, or you attract them. And I thought that was quite interesting, because...
And especially now when, like, all of our interactions are happening online, where you can curate the perfect persona, it's like we're not really seeing people's inner selves. We're seeing the selves that they choose to put out.
Although I think people are becoming more real and authentic, because you're seeing them through the screen, is that actually the blurry lines between who they are at work and who they are at home and what their identity is now, gosh, I've got to answer the door because the Amazon guy's here, or whatever, you know. Is actually that it's become very real. And all this week, this radio conference has almost sort of been making jokes about it, and, you know, what slippers have people got on, and you know, to actually humanize and be authentic to the fact that we need to be kinder to ourselves and real to others. And I think we are being more real, and I think you're doing amazingly.
I was talking to a friend last night, Zoom catch up, who has, like, a high powered corporate law job. And she was explaining that she usually, like, always puts on the digital background on her Zoom, but she forgot to do it. And there were dirty underwear hanging.
Oh, no.
And then she realized and was horrified and got up to move them. And below her, you know, crisp white shirt was her plaid pajama bottom. So then she was, like, showing it, and it was just like a hot mess. So yes, we are getting a window into people's real lives.
There's so shame. Yeah, there's no guilt or shame anymore. We need to have cast all that out and be kind to ourselves. And just getting through every minute or day is fine. That's what I've decided now. So that should help a lot of other women heal, that, you know, they might aspire for your role, but you're still being unkind to yourself and beating yourself up. And everyone needs to be kinder to themselves. This is all about helping people heal and getting through those setbacks, however large or small. We really are in this all together at the moment. And you've led the way for a lot of women to be more equal, supportive, with gender pay gap, and that I love that community fight club that you've got. So which strong women have inspired you then in your life?
You know, honestly, I think I'm more impressed often by, like, the ordinary women who don't have the accolades or credit or name recognition, but are doing incredible things. And so for me, I think it was, like, the women of my fight club who are just ordinary people who have supported me throughout all of the, you know, trials and tribulations of my career and my personal life. And we have supported each other, and they make me laugh. And I think that that is so important. Like, you have to maintain a sense of humor, and we're not in a very funny time right now. Like, everything is so heavy and so serious. But I think if I couldn't laugh, I would spend more time crying.
So what do you do in your time off? Do you have any hobbies there?
What have we been doing? We've been trying to go on more bike rides. I normally, you know, we like to go to the desert where we have this house, and I'm very into home decor, so I like doing that. But we have been trapped here, so I've been doing a lot of rearranging of our one room apartment, just, like, constantly. We just built a new coat rack, and I organized it by color, so that was pretty exciting for me.
Can you come over, please?
Yeah, sounds like I have really fun hobbies. It all sort of blends together.
I think the time is now. So good luck with your future, good luck with the election results, and your future book. We look forward to hearing more about that. And lastly, what wisdom would you say to uplift or influence women or men listening out there?
I think right now it's just like get through the day. Like, it's hard to think very far in advance, and it's easy to spiral thinking too far in advance. Like, we just can't make plans right now. So I think it's just like making the best of each day.
It's just keep on keeping on, isn't it? Just keep healthy and well is what I would, and be kind to ourselves, because we're all very proud that you came on here and very honored. And I'm sure a lot of women and men will be uplifted and inspired by everything you've said and everything that you stand for. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for your inspiring work to support women and to give them, and particularly young women, a voice and equality and support with diversity and in their careers. So thank you. And the Influential Women's Podcast is co-founded and host-presented by exec producers Nikki Bannerman and award-winning Juliet Nichols, and audio produced by Safran Mirza and video produced by Katie Lewis. Please subscribe for free on all podcasting platforms to hear our real-life stories, out every other Tuesday. And if you'd like to collaborate with us for health and well-being stories, please contact Nikki at nikkibannerman.co.uk.